Welcome back to Saving the Remnant on the Fleming Foundation. This is episode 3. I'm your host, Stephen Heiner, and with us as always for this series is Dr. Thomas Fleming. Hello, Dr. Fleming.
Hello, Stephen.
We're continuing our discussion in this series, preparing for the 2021 Summer Symposium. And last time, Dr. Fleming, you painted a fairly dark picture of the Roman West in the 5th century AD. Gaul, which is mostly modern France, Belgium, parts of Austria and Switzerland, were ruled by barbarian Franks, and Italy was falling under the control of German military commanders. And the emperors, you named as Honorius and Valentinian III, were mere puppets. What about the other parts of the West, namely Spain and across the water, North Africa?
There we have a similar story. Barbarian tribes, both Germanic and also the Alani, who are a kind of strange Iranian people who seem to be merged later on, both with Slavs and Germans, they were moving into Spain about 407 BC, so, you know, in the generation after Theodosius. The German tribes were dominated by the Vandals, who were very rough customers at this point, and the Suevi, who are later on, of course, the Swabians, who give an imperial family to the Holy Roman Empire. Roman emperors themselves invited the Visigoths in, who were among the most civilized of these Germanic groups, so they were to act as a counterweight to the other barbarians. Over the years, these Germans took over most of the Iberian Peninsula, although the empire held strips along the coast. The Vandals were displaced by their rivals, by the Visigoths in particular, in 429, and they got the brilliant idea of transferring themselves to North Africa, where they established a kingdom. Unfortunately, there was disputes going on within the Western Empire, and the traditional story is that Count Boniface, egged on by Galla Placidia, sided with the Vandals and invited them to come in and help him. And of course, this is an absolutely disastrous move to have made. The problem with stories like this is that they're so universal, they become suspicious. It's how the Anglo-Saxons came into England. It's how the Moors come into Spain. Always the local rivalry among chieftains, which invites the enemy in.
So does that leave Italy untouched apart from the Visigothic sack in 410 of Rome?
Italy was certainly much better off and remained better off in many respects than Gaul, that is France, Spain, and North Africa. Rome, the city in the early 5th century, by now it had lost political power, but it was still fabulously wealthy. The senatorial upper classes tended to be very conservative. A much higher proportion of pagans, for example, still existed there since the time of Constantine, although most of the nobler families were either moving off to Constantinople or had been Christianized. Senatorial estates from the empire were so vast, particularly in Italy at this time, that Ammianus Marcellinus, who lived in the East, although he wrote in Latin, he says that rivers that once divided nations now flow through the middle of a senator's own estate. Of course, real power in the West had shifted from the Roman capital to Milan and to Ravenna, which is near the mouth of the Po River going into the Adriatic Sea. In Milan and Ravenna, which were well fortified compared with many cities, the degenerate rulers of Rome, that is the emperors and their immediate courtiers and officials, hardly cared what happened down in the Eternal City itself.
Well, I feel Ravenna is in the Dr. Fleming top 5 choices in Italy list, along with Siena, as places you'd like to go. Maybe we could do a winter school there sometime.
You know, we actually did once. So just we were there for 3 days. It was Verona, Ravenna, and Venice. Lovely time there. I've been to Ravenna, I don't know, 4 or 5 times. It never fails to captivate. It's got more late antique buildings than virtually anywhere in Europe, and they're in remarkable state of preservation. Several magnificent Byzantine-looking churches, and as well as the tomb of Galla Placidia and other monuments. It would have the house of Theodoric, the king of Italy, had not a pope unwisely given Charlemagne the authority to tear it down and rebuild it in Aachen. So this famous palace of Charlemagne's is really just a ripoff of Theodoric, who had Roman and Byzantine stonemasons.
So if we keep going east, Dr. Fleming, from Spain and France to Italy and out to the Eastern Empire, what does that look like?
Well, on the eve of destruction, if I may quote the title of a terrible song from the 60s, the empire in general was perhaps a better place to be than anywhere else. There were important differences between the East and West. In the West, the administrative and political bureaucracy was under the control of great landowners. Most of them were senators, and they were a source of power and law unto themselves. They did little to help the empire, either with their tax money or by their attempt to defend it. You know, taxes are never fair, and they're usually disproportionately paid by the working classes. By the working classes, I mean everybody from the guy who drives a taxi to the guy who puts your heart out and sits it on a table and keeps it going. That is, people making hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even $1 million a year, are just working class stiffs compared to the Bill Gateses and Jeff Bezos in the world. At the same time, the over-centralized system of the Roman West left the provinces exposed to never-ending barbarian raids. You could never feel safe, even fairly far into the empire. In the East, it seems a paradox because it was the East that first felt the pressure of the Goths. The system functioned better, partly because they had a more professional civil service. That is, it was staffed by people from fairly humble backgrounds who could not establish a permanent aristocratic power base on their own. So the East had a more flourishing economy. There was a greater mechanical skills, you know, the building trades, pottery. The East was nowhere near, that is the Roman East, nowhere near so desolate as most parts of the West.
That said, Dr. Fleming, it would be 1453, so we're talking about 429, 410, 1453, and obviously that what fell at Constantinople that year was a shadow of what the empire was. But the impression is in the West that it was dying almost from the beginning. How did it manage to keep going for the 1,000 years?
That's the sort of the impression one gets of instant decadence from the beginning, which only got worse. You get it from reading Gibbon, who actually clearly loves certain aspects of medieval Rome and the Byzantine Empire. They overemphasize the weakness and degeneracy of the East Roman Empire, as it should be called. Now, of course, it had its ups and downs, and there were more downs than ups, but the up periods were very real. Justinian, for example, in the 6th century, reconquered North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. Heraclius destroyed the Persian Empire. The Macedonian dynasty later on, a little after Charlemagne, regained the Balkans. The Komneni family successfully maintained the empire against a multifaceted attack from Muslims to the south and east, Slavs in the northern Balkans, and the worst of the enemies of civilization at that time were the predatory Latin crusaders, who in the Fourth Crusade managed to conquer Constantinople, rip everything out. I mean, they behaved like complete savages in their destruction of the churches, which they profaned over minor differences in theology.
Dr. Fleming, as a fellow Latin Rite Catholic, the less that's said about that, the better.
You know, more has to be said because a lot of converts to Orthodoxy, Protestant converts, are now trying to whip up all this hatred against the Catholic Church. And then you get loony ultra-right Catholics who think that everything ever done in the West, the Fourth Crusade was condemned more than once by the papacy. I mean, it was not something where there really is a lot of room. Having prostitutes being serviced on the altar of God in the Church of Santa Sophia is not exactly something we should be proud of.
As I say, Dr. Flavino, I expect our audience is a little bit more conversant in these things than others, but I think anyone who studies church history, actually, if you just limit yourself to the ecumenical councils, you can see the core, as essentially as the West became more stabilized and then essentially associated with the Holy Roman Empire, it started to have the same problems that the East did when the emperor was sitting next to the Patriarch of Constantinople, that the famous tension between those two swords, just because it's in Constantinople doesn't mean that it couldn't happen in Rome, and it did.
No, it certainly did.
That's an entire series, a different entire podcast series, which I'd love to get into, Dr. Fleming, with you. But we have to keep going here. So, unfortunate deviations from crusades aside, what were the qualities that made survival and revival possible?
The Eastern Empire, and this, by the way, is a subject that has interested me since I was a graduate student. The Eastern Empire had certain things. For example, the Greek cultural tradition was older and stronger than the Romans. Roman literature, for example, other than Roman law, is largely derivative of Greek literature. I'm taking nothing away from the magnificence of writers like Livy and Horace and Virgil and Cicero, but they knew that they were living off the Greek inheritance as much as the Greeks were, and we have to recognize it. And the Greek cultural tradition, for example, was already stronger in the 2nd and 3rd century AD than the Latin tradition. They held on better. And the Greek language, they were doing a better job of preserving. Because of their confidence and the strength of their cultural tradition, they seemed to have a better ability to co-opt the barbarians who came flooding in into being allies, defenders of the empire, and eventually being citizens in good standing. The Byzantine Empire was very polyethnic, and yet it did not become a polyglot or multicultural empire. The Greek language and literature over the years dominated. And they had a more far-seeing leadership. At least from time to time, they were blessed with good emperors at the very time that the Latin West was sputtering out.
Now, in the last session, you talked about Stilicho, the Vandal, who resisted Germanic expansion into Italy. How successful was he?
Stilicho was a great success, both as a military leader and as a diplomat. He was a half-German with a Vandal father and a Roman mother, and a Roman education. His rivals, of course, always stressed the fact that he was a half-German and tried to portray him as a barbarian. But the best poet of the age, maybe the last really important Latin poet of antiquity, Claudian, portrays him as one of the last great heroes. He was certainly not a savage, but he was, because of his Germanic blood, I think, he was able to understand and deal with, for example, the Visigoths, with King Alaric, the great Visigothic leader of this time. Modern historians often seem to say that they see no difference between Stilicho and the Gothic commanders who were trying to infiltrate the Roman Empire. But contemporary witnesses saw a great difference. So they saw Stilicho as the last bulwark of Rome against barbarian invasion. His murder at the hands of court officials in 408 was the death knell of the Western Empire. There would never be another Stilicho. He had worked out a deal with Alaric, which included a 4,000-pound gold payment to the Goths. But after his murder, the Emperor Honorius, the son of Theodosius, refused to honor the deal. This is just a very unwise thing to do. Barbarians love gold. This was all the excuse Alaric needed to launch his invasion of Italy and his march on Rome. I mentioned in our last talk together, Alaric's sack of Rome in 410 was a shock to the world. It provoked, among other things, St. Augustine's City of God. There's a story, whether true or not, that when the Emperor Honorius, who was a poultry fancier, heard that Roma was destroyed, he broke out in grief, thinking that his prize rooster named Roma had been killed. Once his courtiers reassured him it was only the capital of the world, he felt a good deal better. Well, the whole period, you know, reads like a romance novel. Honorius didn't seem to care overly much that his sister, Galla Placidia, had been captured by the Goths, and she ended up marrying Adalwulf, an earlier form of the name Adolf, the widowed brother-in-law of Alaric and Alaric's successor. She was later restored to the Romans, but this was a very strange period in which she seemed to be happily married to the Visigoths. She was the mother of Valentinian III, the last of the imperial line of Theodosius, and you can visit her incredibly beautiful tomb in Ravenna. Alaric died soon after the sack of Rome, and Adalwulf, his successor, went to Spain and allied himself with the Romans from time to time. He was not exactly a faithful ally, but then nobody was. If we can believe the sources, Adalwulf was thoroughly impressed with what he saw of Roman civilization, which had been on full display when he joined his brother-in-law in the sack of Rome. And he seems to have talked as if he could become the German military arm of Rome. Whether or not we believe this story, there's an element of truth in it. Germans have always been strongly drawn to the city Rome and to Italy. They love it. The great historian of medieval Rome, the city, Gregorovius, was a Lutheran, free-thinking German. And, of course, he was, in his own mind, an enemy of the Catholic Church. But the Catholic Church kept on giving him decorations because no one had done so much to revive an interest in Catholic Rome.
Well, I suppose there's an unfortunate connection via the name Adolf, therefore. Someone who wants to become the German military arm of Rome. But we'll leave that, Dr. Fleming. He dies in 415. Emperor Honorius follows him in 423. What happens next?
Well, after the death of both Adalwulf and Honorius, Honorius was then succeeded by an equally weak nephew, Valentinian III, the son of his sister. But he ruled in name only. The West was really managed in those days by the magister militum, the master of the soldiers, Aetius, who is often called the last of the Romans. Now, the queen, Galla Placidia, if you could call her that, the empress, the mother of the emperor, resented very much the power of Aetius, and she intrigued with Count Boniface, the ruler of what was left of North Africa, the very man who had made an alliance with the Vandals. He lived long enough to be sorry for what he had done. He returned to Italy and replaced Aetius as the master of the soldiers, and when Aetius rebelled, Boniface defeated him near Rimini, just south of Ravenna. Aetius took refuge with the Huns, who sponsored him for the position of patrician upon the death of Count Boniface. And from then on, Aetius ruled more or less openly until his death in 454. Although he did fail to hold Britain and Africa within the empire, as a patrician, he did keep Italy and parts of Gaul intact. He was a somewhat dodgy character, full of personal ambition as well as concern for the empire, but he was the last really competent person to hold real power.
But it seems the barbarian threat didn't really go away.
No, they never do. It was a very messy situation. Germanic chieftains were struggling for power in Spain and Gaul and over who was going to really be master of what was left of the Western Empire. We're talking about largely Italy. Adalwulf had been murdered in Spain by a personal enemy, but his successors established a Gothic kingdom in parts of Gaul where they collaborated with the Romans, and together they tried to resist the terrifying invasion of Attila the Hun near Troyes in 451. Now, I said last time that other German tribes, not just the Goths and the Franks, also the Burgundians had been entering into Gaul, which they took over for good at this time. Both were allies of the Romans in their confrontation with Attila. In fact, part of the massive folk movements of the 5th century, part of the explanation for them, lies in this remarkable invasion of the completely savage Huns. The Germans were barbarians, but they had many virtues, not the least of which was honor for their chieftain and their bravery. But these Huns were the archetypal enemies of civilization. They're like Tolkien's orcs. They accentuated the natural ugliness by scarring their faces. As soldiers, they were very great horsemen. They're a lot like Comanche Indians. They lived for killing and plunder only. Now, Aetius had made friends with the Huns, and he and Attila were allies, but Attila was overreaching himself, and he demanded marriage with Honoria, sister of the Emperor Valentinian III. When he was refused, he besieged the city of Orléans. Now, in the final battle, the final conflict in which Attila was defeated, or at least it was sort of a draw like Gettysburg, but Attila withdrew from his invasion. In that final battle, it is interesting, a majority of both armies were composed of German troops, German fighters. Of course, he tried to invade Italy once again, but in a famous story, he was stopped by Pope Leo I, Leo the Great, who went and argued with him. We have what Leo is supposed to have said. It's quite impressive. I find it difficult to believe that Attila would be swayed by Christian rhetoric. I think Leo was acclaimed in his lifetime as a very great diplomat, and he may have had a few things to say to Attila about what conquest was going to cost him. Attila had inspired a temporary union between the Western Empire, on the one hand, and the Germans who were living in Gaul on the other. A lot depended on the abilities of Aetius, who unfortunately died in 454. And Italy was again exposed to attack from northern barbarians. In 455, just a year after Aetius' death, the Vandals were strong enough to repeat Alaric's feat, and they seized Rome and plundered all that the Goths had missed. Unfortunately, there were Christian writers who said, oh, you know, the Vandals being Christian, they're actually very nice about their conquest. Nothing could be farther from the truth. All hooligans who deface public property, Vandals.
Well, that's just because you're not sensitive to the fact that Black Lives Matter, Dr. Fleming.
Vandal lives matter, too.
Obviously, this is an ongoing sad story. Were there no competent generals in the wings to assist?
Well, you know, there had been good leaders in the 5th century. We've already talked about Stilicho, the Romanized Vandal, who had done his best to defend the empire from his fellow barbarians, the somewhat shiftier Aetius. Even the Count Boniface was quite competent in his job. There was even one competent emperor, Majorian, who ruled for 4 glorious years. And really, it's a wonderful story. He undertook to repair Rome's crumbling monuments. He passed a law to forbid people from stealing the marble and tiles, something which the papacy was very good at in the Renaissance. He also undertook the difficult task of reforming the army.
Those churches aren't going to build themselves, Dr. Fleming.
I'd take the Roman monuments over most of those Baroque churches. You could take all of them, and I give them to you as a free gift. What the Barbary spared, the Barberini?
The Barberini took,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I'm more of a Santa Maria in Trastevere and Santa Francesca Romana kind of guy. Anyway.
Yeah, they're much more religious, for one thing. Now, why did Majorian fail? Well, for one thing, preventing people from stealing is never a very popular move. So you can bet that Joe Biden, for example, is going to be very popular for a while because he won't stand in anybody's way. But also, the Germans began to eye him with disfavor because he had power, real power, and military ability, and he could use it. The real ruler of Italy at this time was not the Emperor Majorian and his successors, but the Swabian mercenary Ricimer, who made and unmade emperors at will. And we'll see next time that this pattern of power, puppet emperors being ruled actually by mercenary commanders, becomes the rule for the next 20 years.
Are you saying it's all the fault of the Germans?
Remember the war.
don't talk about the war.
Don't talk about the war. There are obviously many, many factors, and I'd like to touch on a few, but I think we should wait till next time and go over the basic reasons why, between 455 and 476, why Rome could not recover any of its energy or ability to defend itself in Italy, whereas in Constantinople, even despite the weakness of some of the emperors, there was a level of competence and energy, especially in resisting and eliminating the German threat, which doesn't happen in the West.
Well, I'm looking forward to continuing that discussion, Dr. Fleming. As always, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you.
This was a presentation of the Fleming Foundation.